Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
We have two guests today, sports handicapper Frank B. and the publisher of Huntington Press and the Las Vegas Advisor, Anthony Curtis. Gentlemen, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Before we get to Frank and Anthony, we have a question from a listener sent to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Seems there's a double-deck blackjack game with strip rules, except blackjack only pays 6 to 5. This game gives excellent penetration and deals down to about 20 cards. The question is, does this penetration make the game playable to a competent card counter?
Well, it would if you were allowed to spread, you know, ridiculously high, but you won't be. So I would say no. I mean, in Vegas, they're just not going to tolerate the kind of spread you would need to beat that game.
Yeah, when I went, you know, Richard's right on. When I saw this question, the first thing that popped into my head is that penetration doesn't really matter at this point. What matters is what your best spread is going to be. You know, your strategy variations that you're going to make because of a deeper penetration isn't going to make the difference. It's going to be bet variation. And if you can't get away with a big bet spread, especially at a single deck or handheld, it's not going to matter.
Right. And they sweat those single decks as if they were single decks, even though they're paying 6 to 5. So, I would say no. Now, you know, if you were playing in the middle of Iowa or something and they had the idea that it's 6 to 5, so it's automatically safe, maybe you could get away with something. I don't know. But in Vegas, no.
Certainly, I would add that the 6 to 5 games are vulnerable in other ways. You know, especially whenever there's a handheld game, a lot of pros that do gray area things in terms of, you know, looking at hold cards and things like that can get away with a lot more at 6 to 5 and make those very beatable games. But strictly on a straight counting game, I would say if you can't make a big spread, then no, it's not worth playing.
Yeah, 6 to 5, you know, they put it in because it's a deterrent to educated players from playing it. So they might as well deal more cards, you know. So it's not, the game itself is not designed for advantage players. It's designed just to get the regulars in there and just get the hands per hour out.
Yeah, get the tourists in who don't care how bad the games are. And speaking, you know, I don't know if we brought this up on a prior show, but somebody sent me a picture that the Venetian now has 000 roulette. So, I mean, 6 to 5 blackjack, you know, at its worst, is still better than even 00 roulette. And 00 isn't good enough. They want 000 roulette now.
No, I hadn't heard that.
That's a new one.
Really?
So that's an extra 2.7%, which would make it, what, 7.1, something like that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
I need to see it. I want to see it.
Now, under
that'd be 8.1, right? It's 5.25 plus
8.1.
Yeah.
You know, there are actually, there are actually at carnivals and things like this in South America, where they would have their, you know, carnival and all of that sort of thing, they would have roulette tables where animals, pictures of animals, acted as zeros. So they were house numbers. And some of these would have 4 and 5 animals on a wheel, on a standard wheel. And people liked it because they liked the animals.
They're so cute.
It's true.
All right. Under the category of we hoped it wouldn't happen, but it did, Caesars Entertainment will begin charging for parking at all of its Las Vegas hotels other than the Rio. Apparently, players with platinum or higher total rewards cards will be able to park for free. Anthony, you might know more about this than any of us.
Well, I've been talking to a lot of media today already about it, and now you guys, you know, it was splashed all over the Review Journal at the front page, and certainly it's big news. But it doesn't surprise anyone. It doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise anybody who lives in this town and knows how this town operates. You know, it was either going to be MGM or Caesars was going to, you know, cast the first stone, and the second was going to watch and then follow along. And that's exactly what happened. Now, what's interesting about this is they're giving a reason for doing it, as, you know, they've always got to justify it. At MGM, it was, you know, we want to give people a better parking environment. So, you know,
whatever that
was a kind of a dumb excuse. But the excuse being used by Caesars is better, and I think it's valid in a lot of ways. And they're saying that a lot of their garages, especially on weekends, are getting overpacked to the point where you can't even park because everyone's using it. And I've seen that. I've literally seen that. I tried to go to the Flamingo and almost couldn't find a parking spot last Saturday. You know, it was Thanksgiving weekend, but still. So there's some validity to what they're saying.
Flamingo in particular seems to have a garage that's too small for that casino.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I'm sure it's a somewhat of a convenient excuse, but I don't think it's a total smokescreen in this regard. The important thing, if they're going to charge for parking, in my opinion, it's okay. But they for it to be okay, they've got to make it so people who are coming in to spend money can park for free. So that means you don't, you know, not necessarily everybody who's a valuable customer to them is going to be high up on their slot card hierarchy, right? So if someone's coming in to eat at for a $200 dinner or a $250 dinner or to see a show where tickets are $100 a piece, they ought to get a free pass, and that's what they're missing on this, I think.
Very good. All right, Frank and Anthony, the two of you have been partners in some football handicapping contests this year and in previous years. So, Frank, starting with you, how has that gone this year?
Well, you know, last year we were partners in on just one. That was the Nugget, and we, you know, finished second. You know, in the finals, we lost on the second tiebreaker, but the format of that contest is one where the first half you have to go through anywhere, I think it was about 49 games. No, actually it was 56 games. And then the top eight make the cut. So it's a make the cut and then a knockdown after that. And the make the cut strategy that we used is pretty strong given the format that they have over there at the Nugget. So we did well last year and we did well again this year. And now we are in the knockdown portion where
it's a head-to-head bracket.
Yeah, so it's a bracket.
Single elimination.
Single elimination, and you know, our edge, admittedly, here is less than it was. You know, in the games leading up, this time it was a 74 game sample with the strategy that we use, which is taking advantage of market inefficiencies. We're pretty strong to make it to the final eight. A good number of times, just because it's very difficult to out handicap somebody who's taken 2 or 3 points the best of it at the current line. And a lot of the players, a lot of the entrants are hardcore handicappers, and that's exactly what they, you know, they get a little annoyed at this strategy. They don't want to use it in the contest, and they insist on just handicapping the games, and they are at a disadvantage against, you know, just guys like us who, you know, we're just going to take what the contest is giving us, and you know, you're going to have.
So you mean the contest offers you stale lines?
Right. There's a 2-day window to get from the point the lines go up to the point you have to have your picks in, and in those 48 hours, the lines shift. And since the Nugget uses not only sides but totals, pro and college totals, there's a lot of movement and a lot to choose from. If you're strictly somebody who's just playing the market moves,
and so you're getting the opening line, even though it's 48 hours later when you make your bets.
It's the opening contest line. It's a game.
Yeah.
They put them up Wednesday, so the lines have been hit already. But you know, it's basically that 48 hour. What's happened during those 48 hours? Yeah, we show up, you know, close to the deadline and take advantage of numbers.
And they could do anything they want, really, with those lines. I mean, they use the lines off the board, I think, when they put them up. But, I mean, they could shade them if they wanted, if they had an opinion it was going a certain way. But you can still use the same strategy. And, I mean, why the reason these contests are good is, first of all, they're pretty much 100% equity situations. Now, the Super Contest changed that this year, and I think they're taking out, was it 8%?
Taking out 8%.
They're taking out 8%, so it's a 92% equity, meaning that, you know, 8% of the money you can't get at. So you've got to be more than 8% better than the field to make that a good play. This one is 100% contest, equity. It's there's a lot of dead money in it. And by dead money, for those who don't know, that's people who enter it and who have very little chance of winning. You know, there's dead money because they're playing incorrect strategies or they think they're better handicappers than they are. And then there's this sort of, you know, market strategy that we use. And Frank's a good handicapper, so we infuse a little bit of that, so that gives us a bit of a double whammy.
What is the advantage to doing this as a duo rather than each individually? And maybe you could meet in the finals.
Well, no. The reason we do it together is, you know, there's limits on entries. We could do the same by bringing in other people and get more entries. One of the reasons we do it is to get more entries. So we like to start off. We also played the William Hill college one. It was the first time this year. And we had three entries apiece in that. And going into the finals there, we were in first and third on that. We ended up with a bad couple of weeks, and we ended up taking second. That contest's over. We got another second. We're the second boys, I guess, or, you know, or something. But we do it that way so we get more entries. We do it because we both have ideas about strategy, so it's always good to have somebody to knock ideas off of. And I do it because I can't handicap my way out of a paper bag, and he can. So yeah. I'm really getting the best of this.
Well, you also have the benefit of one of you can go put the entries in for
that's,
both of you,
that's
right?
Another thing, yeah. And you can always get proxies to help you do that and whatever. But it's just easier. I mean, I found from the day one when I came to this town that it's easier to play with a partner or partners that you can trust, even if it's just for the fun of it. And, you know, also to knock strategy off of. I mean, when we get into these final rounds, Frank makes the primary decisions, but he goes over the ideas with me, and I put my two cents in, and all of it's taken under advisement.
I couldn't agree with you more. I've said often if I had to play alone, I wouldn't play.
Yeah.
I don't care really what the game is.
When it comes to strategy, we very much have a similar outlook on it. You know, we were very much market efficiency players, but with, you know, Anthony is a much better tournament player than I am. I understand the concepts when it comes down to the finer details. You know, he's got it over me on that. And so the combination of efficient contest strategy, and then, you know, now that we're dealing with sports, you know, I have some knowledge there. I think it's good that we throw in together. We get double the entries. And then when it comes down to the end, you know, we make sure that we agree on the way to proceed, because, you know, sometimes I might lean a little more in one direction and it'll straighten me out. And it's always best to point yourself in the direction of basic strategy. Don't get too overwhelmed with your opinion, which is what happens with a lot of these guys in these contests. They say, "Oh, I love this game." Okay, but you're getting a point and a half the worst of it. And, you know, and therein lies our, you know, one of our advantages in these contests.
It's funny. I'll just say real quick. A couple of weeks ago, we were really, really agonizing over something. We do a lot of it over text, you know, instant messaging. And he finally wrote to me, he said, "Thinking is good, thinking too much is not."
So you came in second, William Hill, and now you're final eight or final four at the Nugget?
Final eight right now. Yeah, we're in the, yeah, they take eight. William Hill was very, very on the down low, very quiet. You know, you didn't hear much about it. There were no big announcements or anything else, but there were some good players in there who were playing for a reasonable amount of money. First prize, I don't know, we didn't win it, so I think it was $56,000 was first prize. First prize in this one is about double that, so it's a little bit more important, you know.
What was second prize in the William Hill?
Second prize was
18, something like that?
No, well, we tied for second, so we had to split second and third, and our share of it was, those two combined were 24, we got 12. So, you know, it wasn't a bad quarter's work. It was okay.
Right.
But I'd like to point out, Anthony did most of the work on that one, you know, because on it.
Frank didn't care. It was too small.
And the submission day is Saturday. You know, Nugget's Friday. Even though it interferes with what you're doing on a Friday, I can get it done. But on Saturday, I just don't have the time in the morning because of so much, you know, what's going on with college football. So he would go there, and, you know, we had the agreed upon strategy. I said, just go there and stick him in under, you know, with the criteria that we've agreed upon. And he pretty much did it from start to finish, you know, down the stretch when we were, aware that we're right in it. We would confer about the games, but in the end, he made all the decisions. So he did that one.
I get some credit. Another second place for Anthony Curtis. How about it?
Well, it's a good partnership when you both think you're getting the best of it. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. Now, the NFL season's about three-quarters of the way through. They're good teams we expected to be good, Patriots and Seahawks, among others. They're bad teams we expected to be bad, Browns, 49ers, Jags. They're teams with much better records than we expected, Cowboys, Raiders, and probably the Giants. They're teams with worse records than we expected. Panthers, Cardinals, maybe the Packers. Is this much change between the start of the season and the three-quarter mark typical, or is this week unusual?
Well, as far as, you know, the teams that populate the top of the standings and the dregs of the NFL, you know, there's going to be turnover every year. There's going to be and you can sort of see it coming, especially at the top. You know, it's very difficult to maintain year after year, unless your name is the New England Patriots. You know, so as you can see already this year, like Seattle started a little rough. Who's the other thing? Who won? Denver, yeah. You know, they
Carolina.
I meant Carolina. Carolina started more than rough, and they're probably just about out of it now. And then Denver is. You know, they're chugging along, but they're on the bubble right now. The bottom is a little more easy to predict because you don't have those expectations that carry over from the year before. Disappointing teams. Arizona is certainly one of them. I think at the start of the season, they were in the top three as far as favorites to win the Super Bowl. And I guess in the AFC, you'd have to point to the Cincinnati Bengals. They were probably the favorite or co-favorites to win the AFC North. And when you're dealing with teams like that at this point of the season, they're really good go-against teams because they had high expectations going into the year. And when you in the last quartile of the season, you're looking for teams who are sort of dead. You know, this is a dead team. And a lot of the crappy teams like the Browns and the 49ers, well, they didn't have these expectations, and they're still playing for things like, you know, jobs next year and, you know, jockeying for – but when you have a team like the Bengals who so much was expected of and now they are 3-7-1, it's just a wholesale disappointment for them. And a lot of times they just don't show up, especially on the road. So I don't think this season looks any different than any other season, just the names have changed.
Okay, speaking of the Bengals, last Sunday there was a very weird ending to the Bengal-Raven football game where several players on the Baltimore team intentionally cheated, if you want to call it that.
Cheated.
And they got away with it. With 12 seconds to go, nursing a 7-point lead, Baltimore had a fourth down at their own 11-yard line. Normal strategy is to punt, and the Bengals are going to try a couple Hail Marys or something. Instead, the Ravens held every Bengal they could, about 9 players, and the punter simply waited in the end zone until time expired. Safety was called, awarding the Bengals a useless 2 points, although sometime in the future the same points might not be so useless to gamblers. Baltimore was also flagged for holding. But since an offensive penalty does not put time back on the clock or allow the game to continue, the NFL announced that the play was correctly officiated. My question, do you predict the NFL is going to change the rules to prevent this sort of shenanigan?
Well, my question first would be, why would that be cheating? Wouldn't that be sort of akin to saying card counting in blackjack is cheating?
Yeah, I mean, to me, that was an advantage play. It was I mean, you know the rules better than somebody else.
Tremendous, tremendous play.
Yeah.
As
yeah.
far as I'm concerned.
Fair point.
Did you ever
I was
bet
surprised
on the
it wasn't Belichick, right, who, you know.
I mean, there's a guy who studied the rule book, who knew what to do. He was ready for that situation. He was totally prepared. He caught the other guy off guard. It's tremendous.
Yeah, he's probably been waiting to make that play for 2 or 3 years, right?
Exactly. Well, yeah, and that's a rare one to pull off. Like, you know, Belichick does ones where they actually do have to change the rules. Like, he did the whole reporting thing where he would have players shuttling in and out, and he'd say, I'm reporting as an eligible player. This guy's reporting as, you know, and he would just confuse the defense. They go, well, we don't know who's eligible, who's going to be on the end of the line on this play, and he would just scramble their brains. And but that was a strategy you could do every play, and it got to be such a thing where it became an issue. This one is in the same ballpark. I mean, we saw it in a Super Bowl where one team just says that we want to take a safety here. We're going to take a safety, whether it's running out of the back of the end zone or, you know, creating it through a penalty. You know, it's I see it as an advantage play.
All right, let's assume it was Belichick and it was on a high-profile game like, say, the Super Bowl. Patriots are leading Cowboys, maybe, by 6 points. A minute to go, fourth and long at their own 20. Everybody's real excited to see whether Dak Prescott and Ezekiel Elliott can stage a huge comeback. And with almost a minute to go. But instead, the Patriots hold everybody in sight. And by the time they finally take the safety, only 10 seconds are left. And turns out to be not enough time for those kids to take their to make their miracle win. Now, the Patriots have a few haters out there. Now, the fact that the Sharps lost on the no safety, that wouldn't bother the NFL. They're not really protective of gambler. But would that, such a high-profile game, would that cause the rules to be changed?
Well, you know, anything like that that appears to be like an angle shot is going to cause at least discussion. I mean, hack a Shaq, hack a DeAndre Jordan, hack an Andre Drummond. I mean, stretching NBA games out to 3 hours because you realize that he's going to average 0.8 points per possession if you just hack the guy as opposed to the 1.2 that the team normally gets. You know, that's an angle shot. And, you know, some guys, coaches like Popovich will do that for like 15 minutes of the game just to keep you from catching up. And then it causes discussion. Should we change the rules? I mean, you know, it just depends how prolific, you know, how prevalent it becomes, how often the tactic is used.
That one fries me because to me the question is, shouldn't we change the rules? The question is, shouldn't the guy learn to shoot freaking free throws?
The answer is you're trying to force the opposition's hand. Take him out of the game then. If he's so horrible at shooting fouls and you don't like this tactic, take him out of the game. Put somebody else in, you know, because he's a rebounding, you know, they're all rebounding monsters, but they can't shoot you know, everybody goes, why can't they shoot a free throw greater than 45%? But they just can't.
They can. They just need to practice. The other thing that I found mind-boggling is that, you know, Will Chamberlain, when he switched to shooting granny style, he got up to like a 70% free throw shooter or something.
Yeah,
and then he switched back.
Thing attached to that. You know, the first guy who starts shooting granny style. You know,
I think we'll be a hero, actually. If one of these guys did it, if Shaq did it and went from 50% up to 75, I think, you know, every kid in school would start shooting that way.
It didn't bother Rick Barry much, did it?
Yeah.
I mean, you know. Yeah. But to answer your question, which I don't think it's important, but they'll talk about it, sure. Whether they change it or not, it doesn't matter. It's like everything else. When they change the games in a casino, when there's a different rule, then you take it. Okay, fine. Now these are the rules, and now I'll take a different approach.
Right. So, it's like when they brought in shoes to beat card counters. Well, they started playing against the shoes. I mean, exactly what you're saying. The rules change, and you figure out a way to best take advantage of them.
All right.
Did you have a bet on the Bengals?
Not at all. Not at all.
Did you have a bet on no safety?
It was hard to get that down in mid-season non-televised games. It's hard to get propositions.
I would love that. I didn't see it. I heard about it. If I had been watching that, I'd have loved it.
Yeah.
I'd have just laughed.
I'm with you there. I love it.
Yeah, well, there's been some similar plays, and you have to assume that Pete Carroll and Belichick and some of the other sharp coaches were prepared for that. For when they could use it, they just didn't have the right situation for it.
You know, we've talked about Fezzik a few times on this on the show, and Fezzik used to always say, "Why don't they hire me?" That's what he would say. Why don't they hire me? And what he meant by that was someone like him who was really a quant and really, really analytical to look at things like time management, and to look at loopholes and rules, and to look at situational positions, to stand right next to the coach at the end and say, "Do this." And I have to agree with them. Why don't they? I mean, why wouldn't all four of us in this room be able to get a job with the NFL? I mean, we ought to.
Yeah, I think they're afraid to do those things because of...
I don't want to stand outside in 5 degrees below zero.
Yeah, I think they're afraid to do those things because they're afraid of losing their job. Belichick will do them, right? And take the flack when he didn't convert the fourth down.
Yeah, he has the credit built up to get away with gambling and failing.
Yeah.
Even if the gamble is absolutely the correct call, he can take that gamble, fail, and they say, well, listen, he's 15 years of doing things right. That must have been the right decision.
Yeah. I one of the things that I find really maddening when I watch football is how stupid they are about the two-point conversions. And, you know, when it's clear, just like clear that, that you should go for 2 points and they don't, you know?
All the time.
All the time, yeah.
No, not all.
No,
the
no,
time.
I don't mean on every play. I mean there are some plays where it's just like you're ahead by 4 and if you kick the if you miss the 2-point conversion, you're going to be ahead by
4.
Well, 4 or 5.
That's yeah, a, 4 know, or 5. Yeah, yeah, 4 yeah, or 5. Exactly.
But if you go for 2, you can be 6. And it's which is, you know, a little better because at least it takes a couple field goals out of the equation or it takes
And in either their case, extra point, the other team has to score a touchdown to get past you anyway.
Right.
You know.
Right. But well, they've got their, you know, they've got their sheets. They refer to that all the time. Those sheets have been thought out as the
Yeah, and then
they
all
got
it.
Those sheets. Yeah, and then they ignore those sheets sometimes, yeah.
Well, those sheets don't really tell the difference between whether it's quarter one or
no, they do.
Quarter.
Their time, they're you know, at this with this much time left, you may go for 2 with, but if you had more time left, you would just kick the 1. They do take into account how much time is left in the game. Those sheets. It's not because you're not going to play the same strategy in the first quarter as you do the fourth.
Okay,
you know, because Mike Tomlin goes for 2 almost every time to start the game, and you know, guys who bet. And, you know, maybe they have a ticket with something that involves a 7 or 3, and all of a sudden the Steelers are up 6-0. Or they're up 8-0. They go, oh, here he's already at it. He's already messing with my key numbers with these going for 2 things. And, yeah, but he doesn't stick to that strategy later in the game. It's more specific as to the numbers that are involved with the finite time period left.
Here's a weird one with for me. I heard last week, I was watching one of the games, and he got down to the end, and there was an onside kick attempt. You know, it was at the end of the game, and the only chance for the team to win was to recover the onside kick. And the announcer said that only 2 onside kicks had been successful to this point of the year. I can't see how that can possibly be. That's what he said. But look at the perception we have. When your team scores, and they're almost out of it, and you go, great, now we got a great chance because there's an onside kick. The reality, if that number is correct, is like you have almost no chance.
Right? Well, wait, but 2 out of how many?
Out of, well, I would assume out of dozens and dozens, I would think.
Really? I mean, do you see an onside kick every week?
Well, there's...
Oh, yeah, with 16, you know, yeah, however many games there are.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, and we're in week 12 or whatever. I mean, yeah, I would think so. Does that sound right?
Yeah, no, the number of successful ones at 2, that's the one that, if you'd asked me, I'd have said... It'd been at least double that, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 or something like
maybe
that.
Maybe this team had only had 2, or maybe this particular kicker had only had done.
I think he said in the entire league, and I mean, the point I'm making
possible,
about
because
that
when
is
they
that,
when they're successful, they stick out so much. It's like a selective.
I guess it's just our perception of it is so skewed. You know, I mean, you think your team's got a 35% chance of recovering an onside kick, you know, or 25 at least, and it's not even close to that by these.
Actually,
numbers.
I thought the figure was much higher, like over half, if they don't know that it's going to be an onside kick, I guess.
As yeah, well, you know, well, then the instances of attempts like that are rare, you know.
Right.
You
know.
When you're talking about silly play coaches makes, the ones that burns me is you're approaching the 2-minute warning, so like there's 2 minutes and 6 seconds to go, and they call a timeout to get one more play before the 2-minute warning. They're only gaining 6 seconds by this. And if they wait until just after the 2-minute warning, they're gaining 40 seconds of clock time. So, but yet a whole lot of coaches will call for a timeout just before the 2-minute warning. Now, to me, that seems silly. Is that way off or?
You mean if they didn't call the timeout, they wouldn't get the playoff?
No.
In other words,
but it's like you're getting 2 timeouts for the price of 1.
Well, they're always going to get the 2-minute warning.
Right. Yeah, but, so you're getting that timeout, but this way you're getting 2 timeouts in a row.
Well, yeah, but then you only have 3 timeouts and a half, and so you've used one of them, and you only gained stopping the clock for, you know, by 6 seconds by doing that. But if you'd called that same timeout at 1:55 or whenever that play was over at the end, you could, you know, stop 40 seconds from running off. It seems like
a
whole.
Think about it.
Sometimes it has to do with the intended play that they're going to call. You know, they're going
to. What I don't understand is why, when they have 1 minute left, why they just take a knee for a few downs and run out the clock before halftime, I'm talking about. Why not try to make? Why not try to score?
With a minute, they would. With
all right, 40 seconds. I mean,
I agree with that one. Just fling it.
Well, or yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. It's a free shot, right?
Yeah,
sort of. I mean, field position has a lot to do with it. You know, they're on the 15 with 30 seconds to left and no timeouts. Yeah, a lot of teams will just kneel and say that's enough for this half.
Why are we even talking about this? Yeah, think of the audience out there going, "What are they talking about?"
Yeah. All right, I think I was just asked to ask a different question. All right, now, since last time you were on, Frank, DraftKings and FanDuel announced a merger of their fantasy leagues. How do you think this will affect players?
Yeah, we'll make up some time here. I really don't have an opinion on that. Okay. I'm not a DFS player, and I don't know. I guess if they consolidate their product and make it so you only have one choice, I guess you know you're dictating how things are going to go to your clientele, and it's either take it or leave it.
But yeah, lack of competition can't be a good thing.
No, it can't. But I'll tell you what. I think this is going to be a good thing, and the reason is because they're going to quit fighting amongst each other, and they're going to figure out a way to get this legal again in more places. I mean, this thing was a runaway train last year when it happened, and people like it. People really, really like it, and the government steps in and goes, "No, you can't do this," and the whole thing just fell to crap. I mean, everything just went right out the window. All the momentum they had was gone. I think this is actually a good idea. If there were only two companies in the world and they were getting together, I'd say this is one of the worst things that could happen. But there's lots of DFS companies out there. There's a bunch of them. We just never heard of them. And they're going to pop up and you're going to hear about them once these two big guys get together, save their industry and themselves and get the thing legalized where people can start playing it again. Then you're going to see competition popping up. I've talked to a lot of the other companies who want to work through LVA and do deals with us, affiliate deals through the website. And it's amazing how many of them are out there and what they're willing to offer the customers. In the end, this is going to be a very, very good thing. I was glad to hear it.
Now, in Nevada, you can't bet on FanDuel or DraftKings, but there is something called U.S. Fantasy. Is that any – how is that working?
I like those guys, but it's not working out very well. You know, Frank knows more about this, and I'll let him do the talking. But essentially, the model is not right now, and people aren't really playing it. And you'll hear other people defend it and go, "Oh, yeah, they are. Yeah, they are." But if you really talk to sportsbook directors, it's really a non-event right now. That can change. Frank will tell you what they need to do.
Well, you know, the primary problem is you're going to compare that to FanDuel and DraftKings as far as the experience for the player. And in order to participate in U.S. Fantasy, you have to go to the sportsbook. It's a parimutuel system, so there's a tote board. And quite frankly, and I've talked to sportsbook guys, some of them don't even devote a board to displaying the odds for U.S. Fantasy. They say it doesn't really merit the space, was the words of one guy. He goes, but if you go to the little TVs where you sit down, there's a channel where you can tune to it and get it. Now, that's not really putting it in the forefront so that it's like right in your face as you're in the sports book. You got to go hunting for it. But even more important than that, the availability in the sports book is the fact that DFSers are used to doing things on the computer or on their phone. It needs an app. It needs the ability to do it from home, to ask these guys who have for years been betting, you know, sitting in their underwear in their house, punching in lineup after lineup on very efficient mobile betting platforms on these apps. Now you got to go to the casino. I got to hunt down these lines. I got to sit here and fill out stuff. And so this is not going to work. It's got to be available on an app. And, you know, we've discussed this. Maybe, you know, this is a big picture project that U.S. Fantasy has. You know, they're looking down the road, and this is just laying the foundation for it. But, you know, as it is right now, you're not going to convince these guys that it's worth it to go to make the trip to the sports book to go and bet this, you know, in other words, take two steps backwards in, you know, the experience of betting fantasy.
A lot of people who bet DFS, even in Nevada, had never been to a sports book. You know, a lot of these people were not casino people. they're just fans. And all of a sudden they had a way to play this really cool game and play it for money. And they don't know anything about a sports book. They're afraid of sports books. They wouldn't go in there because they'd be intimidated. They wouldn't know what to do. So not having it in a mobile online fashion is what kills it anywhere. You know, they've got to make it mobile.
Which is more likely, fixing U.S. Fantasy or getting DraftKings and FanDuel allowed in Nevada?
Ooh, that's a good question. I would say the former because all the sports books are making apps. You know, I mean, they've all got them now. You know, I mean, you can they're all mobile betting. And I would be shocked. I don't know that they are because I'm not that close with the group of Salerno and those guys over there, but I'd be shocked if they don't have one in development right now. And you're not going to see FanDuel and DraftKings come back to Nevada. It ain't going to happen because that would be them admitting that they are, you know, they would apply for a gambling license. That would be admitting that they're gambling, and it would screw their situation in all kinds of other states who say that they're not a gambling game.
But didn't they apply overseas for, you know, to be recognized as a gambling entity? Didn't that take place in the last year?
That I don't know. Not something I've heard of that they would have needed to do. I don't know. I just know that the hang up here is that to get a gambling license means you're dealing a gambling game. And they don't want to be known as dealing a gambling game. But
there's this big push now with the AGA to legalize sports betting in the United States. And if they get that through, then there's no downside for them to say, oh, yeah, by the way, I guess we are gambling.
Yeah, we were talking about this yesterday. Okay, so when's it going to happen? When's the over-under? I said 2 years for legalization of sports betting, maybe two and a half. But I would say 2 years is right about where I put it. I think before 2 years, you're going to see U.S. Fantasy with a mobile app. Mm. So
it has to be part of the overall plan. Yeah. It just has to be. I can't believe they conceived this whole idea. And then spent all that money to get it going, and they didn't have a mobile app, you know, somewhere in the plan.
Yeah, it's surprising they started without it.
All right, let's change subjects. Let's talk about teaser betting. What are teasers, and what's going on with them, Frank?
Well, teasers are something that the local guys, the guys in Nevada, they desperately want to be able to bet within the state, but that the availability of teasers and the attractiveness of the prices that you have to pay to bet teasers has, you know, slowly disintegrated over the last 5 or 10 years. You know, it's been going on for a while now, and online is the place you go to bet teasers. They are still available in the books, but at ratcheted up prices. Probably the best you can find in this city is -$1.20 for the most popular teaser, which is a 6-point two-teamer.
So explain real quick what a teaser, how a teaser works.
A teaser is you're going to get an additional, the traditional teaser, you get an additional 6 points, and then you're taxed. You have to make a bet similar to a parlay. You have to have at least two teams involved, and both have to win, and then you're paid at a set pay schedule. In this case, currently it's you lay $1.20. So you take two teams, you'll get a 6 additional points on each team, and you'll lay $120 to win $100. What a teaser really is, you get 6 points. It's basically two alternative point spreads parlayed together. So in your head, if you want to look at it in terms of money line, you're basically parlaying two money lines of -270 together, or somewhere in that range, and that's what a teaser is, and that's how they came up. You know, that's how the math works out, as far as how they came to charge you $1.10 or $1.20 for a teaser.
So here in town, it's $1.20 for a 6-point teaser. And what would you pay online?
Online, what you're looking for, the most prevalent acceptable pay is $1.10. You can find better. There are places that run $1.05. There's even a few still left that do even money, which is the traditional, 20 years ago teaser that Vegas, used to offer. A couple places offer ties win, which is a very attractive advantage if you know how to do it. You sort of orchestrate everything so that your results land on whole numbers. So the ties win comes into play on every leg of your teaser. In town, they started going up to $1.20. People were as the NFL point spreads just continued to tighten over the years. In other words, results came very close to the point spreads. You've heard people say, well, how do they come so close on the point spread almost every game? Well, if that's the case, then teasers are a good thing to bet, because you know you're getting your little buffer zone there on the team that you select, and you miss by a couple points where your teaser is going to cover. This past week, things are starting to come to a head again, because the houses got crushed. The houses lost overall this week in Vegas, and the primary item that they're pointing to for the loss is they got crushed on teasers. On Thanksgiving Day, there were six teams in play. Five of them covered the teaser number. Only the Colts, who nobody was really interested in backing because they didn't have Andrew Luck, they're the only ones that failed to cover the teaser. And on Sunday, I don't know the distribution, but they got beat up really bad because all the seven and a half point favorites that people teased down to around a point or two, they all covered the teaser number, but only 5 of 11 of the decent sized favorites covered the point spread. So teasers were the way to go this week, and as a result, the books lost overall in week 12.
There's a common thought out there, or you know, that goes around, people saying that teasers are for squares. You know, that was the thought for a long time, and a lot of teasers overall, if you do them indiscriminately, you just go, I'm going to tease this, I'm going to tease that, then yeah, they are for squares with the extra vig and all of that. But guys who really know their stuff make very good use of teasers in a lot of ways.
And that's what keeps teasers going, are the squares. You know, you'll have guys, you know, if you learn the basic strategy of teaser betting, you'll learn a few things right off the bat. Don't tease totals. Whatever 6 points you're going to gain are not worth enough to compensate for the additional price that you're paying. You know, basically you got to take a $1.10 offering or an even money offering when you remove the juice, and you got to win. So that's 50% win percentage. You got to get it up into the low 70s to make a teaser leg worth including in your bet. Now, you're never going to gain enough percentage points to take your win percentage from 50% to like 72, 73% on a total. Those numbers just aren't worth enough. But on the point spreads, they are, because the 3 is worth a bunch, you know, the 7 is worth a bunch, and everything in between that is worth enough to get you above 20%, an added 20% win probability. And that's, you know, that's the essence of basically betting teasers. Is it's a very simplified way of explaining it, but you're grabbing the whole 3 to 7 block and getting on the outsides of each of it and including that. Now, like I said, it's a very simplified way of looking at it. And if you just go out there and blindly bet that, I don't know that you'll win, but that you're close. You're getting close to the way to go about winning a teaser betting.
All right.
So when they got crushed on teasers this week in Vegas, that was not sharp money, because the sharp money is betting it at $1.10 and even money offshore.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of big bettors that pine away. You know, they just want to bet teasers, and they'll accept laying that $1.20. And, you know, maybe they're making break-even bets. I mean, they're not great bets, and in comparison to what you can accomplish off online, they're inferior. But a lot of people want to bet teasers, and, in Las Vegas, what they've done is they've taken away your ability to bet the most popular version, which is a two-teamer. But if you start to move up the scale, you learn your numbers, your probabilities, and you go up the scale, there are still teasers available in the Vegas books that are actually better than a two-teamer where you get paid $1.10. You just have to be willing to submit more legs.
And live with the variance.
Yeah.
Live with the variance, and also the fact that you have to find, you know, the most prevalent one that is available is a six-teamer. There's a lot of books that will pay you plus 700 on a six-teamer, and the effective win percentage required to break even on that is less than 71% per leg, which is better than laying $1.10. Laying $1.10 on a two-team six-pointer, you have to hit around, I believe it's 72% per leg to break even. Even on the six-teamer, it pays plus 700, it's just under 71%. So it's actually a better deal, but you have to find six teams simultaneously that you're willing to put on a ticket all at once, which is, you know, the all at once part. Yeah. is a tough one, and it's another aspect of online betting that makes teaser betting there far superior, because online, at a lot of places, you have the ability to create open teasers, which means tonight or tomorrow night or whatever it is, Dallas is playing and you want to, and you're really hot to play them, you can start a teaser, play Dallas, and leave the rest of the spots open. You leave them open until a later time when you come, when you decide that there's a team at the price that you want available that you'd like to include in the teaser. You just start plugging them in until you fill out your teaser. And using that method, every game that you select for your teaser is timed to be put into the play at exactly the price that you want, that you feel is best. It's a far superior way to bet teasers, and it's one reason that betting in Vegas is going to be very difficult to compete with betting offshore, you know, because that's actually an advantage that is going to be hard to implement here in town, you know, letting people like alter their tickets. Maybe you can do it on the app, you know.
Going to your point, though, that's probably what happened. There's probably a lot of, you know, the squares were hitting their kind of unconsidered teasers. You know, I'm going to do a teaser no matter what, and I'm going to tease totals, and I'm going to tease this 12 points to 18, and you know, this kind of business that's not really that valuable. And yeah, they're the ones.
And they won. Some weeks they're going
to
win.
That's why we continue to gamble.
And the books are not. And the books will overcompensate and. Because they're not smart enough to realize that it wasn't the sharp money that beat them up.
And teaser betting is very correlated. I mean, what one guy bets is very going to be very much like what the next guy. They all want to tease the favorites down to a better number. So when those teams cover the teaser number, it's not like they had action on the other side. You know, it's sort of an all or nothing thing. I mean, the books do have really good teaser weeks, you know, because a handful of the big favorites just didn't cover the teaser number. Then they wipe out all the teasers then. So, you know, the sportsbooks here in Nevada have a way of crying the blues when they have a bad week, but you don't hear about the other weeks where they crush them.
You mentioned Dallas. We're taping this Wednesday, the day before Dallas plays Minnesota on Thursday night. A couple days ago, Dallas was favored by 2.5, and now they're favored by 3.5. That's only 1 point, but that strikes me as huge, that they would go across the 3-point line. So is this pretty rare that the numbers would cross that 3-point line in them? Now, I didn't give you any preparation for this question.
No, so. I'm just looking at the line movement, and you're absolutely right. I see as high as 4 out there now. And the primary reason is Dallas, a lot of guys have been betting against Dallas the entire season. I happen to be one of them.
Me too.
The odds are I had a bet against Dallas almost, 3 out of every 4 weeks.
How have they done against the spread?
They did not cover the first game of the season.
Yeah, the first game of the season.
They've covered just about every one of them. I really think, it's the way that they, you know, you have to take a look at them. You have to give them credit because it's the way that they go about things with that offensive line. You think down the stretch you have a shot at the back door, but all they do is they get the ball and they go on an 8-minute drive, and you can't stop them. You can't stop them getting 5 yards a clip, and then they end up getting a field goal, a touchdown, and you don't get the back door. They tack on another score. They're going to be a team that's going to be tough to derail entirely because you'll think about it. Who on their team could get hurt that would really cripple them?
Well, if Dak Prescott got hurt, you'd have to go to Tony Romo.
Yeah, well, what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
And even if Ezekiel Elliott gets hurt, behind that offensive line, Alfred Morris is what they call a professional running back. He will bust out 100-yard games with regularity behind that line. Where he is not quite the player that Zeke is he doesn't catch the ball quite as well, and he's not good in pass blocking, which is something that you don't hear. You know, Ezekiel Elliott is a good pass blocker when he doesn't have the ball, so that's why they keep him down. They call him a three down back. But the whole offensive line is not going to get hurt. You're not going to get hurt if Dak Prescott go out. It might even turn out better. You got a professional quarterback in Tony Romo going back there, and maybe the story comes out. Everybody's happy in the end. The most important player on Dallas that they cannot afford to lose is Sean Lee on the defensive side. He's a tackling machine at linebacker. He's sort of the center of it. And if they lose him, then there's no replacement for that. And they are, you know, that's the weaker element of their team anyway, is the defense. They cannot afford to lose Sean Lee. But outside of that, you know, they're going to be tough to see a drop-off in performance out of them.
And I have to acknowledge it because I didn't want to believe. Like, I had that rookie quarterback. He's going to start to flounder. But behind, you know, that offensive line covers up a lot of mistakes.
I made one season wins bet for the entire college and NFL season, and it was Dallas under 8.
How's that going?
Well, you see, at the beginning of the year, you know, there was a lot of guys that did that because of the Romo thing, you know, just like a lot of guys faded the Vikings as soon as Teddy Bridgewater went down. You know, I know a lot of guys out there that got under 9 and under 9.5 even tickets, and, you know, they start out 5, all they do is start out 5-0.
About Dallas, in a week and a half after this show, they're going to play the Giants again in New Jersey. Assuming the line is 0, I don't know what it's actually going to be. If it were 0, who would you like between Dallas and
Giants? So this one's got to be in New York, right? Because
yeah,
one
in
was
New
in
York.
Dallas. Well, you know, like I said, it's, you know, that offensive line is something that's not going to all suddenly get worse.
Giants have played well, too.
What do you say the line is going to be? Pick?
Yeah, I'd say it was pick. Now, usually in rivalry games, it might be Giants are favored, but Dallas is
pretty
good. I like the one where I can lay 105, whichever side that is, if it's a little tilted. How about that?
That's tough to see. You know, they like to say that it's tough to beat a team twice in the same season, and it's, you know, all you can count on is more likely than not, just like game one, it's going to be a close game. All these divisional games, Dallas, Washington, New York Giants, whatever combination you can, they're all great teaser plays if the point spread is sitting on the proper number. They all really make good teaser plays, and that goes not only for that division, for just about, you know, certainly the Baltimore-Pittsburgh division. So, I mean, there's a proper way to go about playing the game, and maybe it's not with the point spread. Maybe it's by using a teaser, or maybe it's by betting an under or whatever, but you know, if there's one constant that seems to be when Dallas plays the Giants, it's going to be a close game.
Yeah. Actually, they could meet 3 times this year. Wouldn't
sure they could. It's Baltimore and Pittsburgh did it like 2 years in a row.
All right. Before we get more to another football question, Anthony, what's happening at the Las Vegas Advisor and or Huntington Press that our listeners want to know about?
Well, all I know is that I'm euphoric at the moment because I just sent the December issue to the printer.
Oh, you get to sleep tonight, huh?
Oh my goodness! I tell you what, writing the LVA is getting tougher and tougher. And I don't know, man. I've been doing this for a long time. I was talking to somebody from Station Casinos yesterday, and I says, you know, that the Las Vegas Advisor is the longest running gambling periodical of all time. You know, there's never been one that's run longer.
Wow.
Yeah. And I mean, I just started realizing that, and it's getting tougher and tougher, you know, to knock these things out. Not because there's hard things to find. I mean, this year, this week alone, I mean, what's for this issue alone, there's 2 unbelievable deals for people who live in Las Vegas. SLS from the 1st to the 23rd, December 1st to December 23rd, 50% off your entire bill, including alcohol, in all restaurants except Bazaar Meats. I mean, that's a great deal for locals. I mean, I wish it was for everybody because we have so many LVA people that are not from Vegas. But 50% off in Katsuya, 50% off in Clio, you know, in all these restaurants. If you ever wanted to try SLS, now's the time. There's a place on the Strip that's slinging nickel beers. On the Strip, nickel beers every night from 5 till 6, 1 hour a night. And it's at the Flamingo inside in Margaritaville. So
can you order 6 beers at,
you know,
5
you can,
minutes to
you can you, you know, can
a, it's a pitcher it's, for a quarter or something.
Yeah, it's a 5 o'clock somewhere bar, right out of the Jimmy Buffett song. And it's funny because what we wrote about it in this issue is that as good a deal as this is, we almost didn't put it in the top 10. Why? Because of the problems that are inherent with bartenders who don't like this promotion. You know what I mean? A bartender, all the bartender sees is a bunch of drunks getting beers for a nickel. And
they get tipped a penny each time.
Yeah, they don't know how to toke. They don't know what to do. They don't want to toke, you know. And so what's happening? The bartenders are working harder for less. And that's a problem. It's an inherent problem with a deal like this. But it's just so cool. I mean, I got to admit, so far they're handling it very well at the Flamingo, and they're moving those beers. But I hear them grumbling because I go there and listen, right? And I hear them grumbling. But it is a cool way to start off. You could drink about 6 beers in an hour, and they give you a check for 30 cents. You know, in fact, when I went up to try it, I ordered one, And the bartender just shook his head, and he saw a nickel laying there. He picked it up and showed it to me. He said, I got this one. So, you know, it's just we're finding cool things. We're continuing to do what we do, finding cool things. We're getting very, very close to beta testing a new website. This is a website I've been promising for 5 or 6 years. I guarantee you, everyone listening, it's happening. And we'll probably beta test it starting in December, and we'll probably unleash it in January or February. And it's a whole new, it's just a whole new scene. It's very, very cool. We'll be bringing, you know, this show and Gambling with an Edge, the podcast and the website will be folded into it. Hopefully a lot more traffic. We get a lot of traffic now, but I think with all the promotion we'll do, you know, that's where my time is being spent right now. That, and of course, putting together a great member rewards book for 2017, which we've already got. We got some good ones coming on. Cosmopolitan's coming on with their Wicked Spoon Buffet, for one. And, you know, a lot of good casinos with good offers for next year.
All right. We have one more question for Frank about esports and millennials. And before we get to that, let's hear a little bit from our sponsors. South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. From December 11th through 24th, you can pay for virtually everything at the South Point for half price using your points. You don't have to be a local to do it. You just need the points. The points don't have to be earned in December, just spent. Now, this is a promotion that has run for several years, and many players accumulate the points all year long. I've had gourmands tell me that Michael's is now a steal. Now, Michael's is a very expensive steakhouse. But at half price, if you're someone who can appreciate what's there, it's quite a good deal. The Wizard of Vegas, which is run by a friend of the show, Michael Shackelford, has listed all the casinos, ranked all the casinos in Las Vegas on video poker. South Point is number one. So this just came out a day or two ago. It's where the South Point belongs on average, in my opinion. And I'm happy that they're there. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the games. The game of the week is Ultimate X 10 Play. Ultimate X is 10 coins per line, where each hand you earn multipliers that you redeem next hand. Very high volatility. The strategy is very different than regular video poker. In the classes at the South Point for starting in January, we're going to be teaching a new version, a new game, 8-6 Bonus Poker Deluxe Ultimate X. That comes in at around 99.7. And the strategy is not that hard. And it's much, much, much lower volatility than the double-double bonus Ultimate X, which is their highest returning game in that category. But it has very high volatility. So we're going to be doing that on the semester starting in January. My best guess is the classes are going to start on January 11th. It's not been 100% finalized, but it's looking that way. All right. Back to Frank B. and Anthony Curtis. Frank, the college playoffs, four teams. What's different about it this year than last year?
Well, what's not different, because it's a new system, you know, we're sort of learning along with the NCAA how this is going to play out, and it's creating some drama, not only near the end of December, but, you know, currently right now, because they created a whole show each Tuesday night devoted to telling you who they have put at that current time into the four positions that will play for the national championship. And you know, as of this week, we have you know, a couple teams with different types of resumes vying for that fourth spot. It's pretty clear that Alabama's going to be in no matter what happens in the conference championship. So win or lose, they're going to be in. They've just done too much to this point to be excluded. Clemson is probably in the same boat, and Ohio State got there last week by beating Michigan. So pretty much three of those three are going to be in, and we're just dealing with the fourth spot, which is between let's see, Michigan, Washington, Wisconsin, and Penn State, I guess. And, you know, the decision is not based on any set criteria. It's not, well, you win your conference championship, and that's worth this much. Because Michigan is not going to win their conference championship. They're not even playing for it. Ohio State didn't win theirs. They're already in. And Wisconsin and Penn State, they neither one of them may make it because Washington is still in the mix. And it's like, you know, how do you decide who it is that you're going to put in that fourth spot? So that's all going to get decided this week.
If Washington beats Colorado, clearly, then they're like...
You mean convincingly?
Convincingly.
That, yeah.
Then since they're fourth this week, they're likely to stay fourth.
You would think so, you know. But Michigan apparently has a lot in the bank as far as
they're arguably
opposition
the best
they've beat. And it's certainly if they beat if Colorado emerges from the out west, Michigan beat them, you know. So then you got that whole argument that could take place. And, you know, with Penn State beating Ohio State, and if they win,
Michigan is arguably the best team in the Big Ten.
You could say that, yeah. And, so you have that whole drama that's been created that, you know, replaced, you know, just the whole voting system at the end of the year. This is clearly better. This is clearly more entertaining. And when it comes down to the end of the year, you know, we have this whole thing with New Year's Eve and then rolling into the next week, the championship game. And, you know, personally, I love the fact that the two games are played on New Year's Eve that determine who plays for the national championship. You know, as a guy, you know, on the wrong side of 50, I don't do the parties anymore. It's usually a pretty quiet night. New Year's Eve, you know, you turn the town over to the crazies and you stake at home. But now with these games, I mean, they're great. These are, you know, two very important college football games with a lot of buildup going into them, weeks of buildup going into them. And it's a great night you know, for a sports bettor. Here in town, you know, I don't know. The jury is still out on how that affects New Year's Eve in Vegas, because it's traditionally, you know, it's a huge party thing. All the high rollers come in, and you got the big parties and the $300 room rates and everything. But some of those guys coming in like football.
Right, so, yeah. You know. Yeah, the football can't hurt. I mean, I don't see how it could hurt.
Well, when you have to make a choice between going to the New Year's Eve party or watching one of the, you know, TV puts them right in prime time. It's right when the parties start. You know, you're going to be in game two. Game two is going to start.
Right.
You know, you got to make a choice. Hey,
still,
honey, you know, I know you got that gown.
Come to Vegas, they're going to have the TVs all over the casino, and at midnight you can go out to the strip and watch the fireworks still. I mean,
yeah.
I think it'll be good. I mean, I think it'll be a plus.
Yeah, I mean, like the ratings were sort of mediocre last year. It was the first year. And so we'll see how if it picks up. I like I said, I'm a big proponent of it. I hope it catches on and it becomes a tradition, because I love that part of it. I think it fits in well with the bowl season, because bowls are something when it comes to sports betting that to handicap them takes a little more than the average regular season game, because there's so many situations that are present in a bowl game that just aren't there. In the regular season, it's pretty, it's each team is trying to win the game. They're using all the players available to reach that goal. But in the bowl season, you know, there are certain teams that are disappointed to be in the bowl that they're in. There are certain teams that, you know, have been trying for many, many years to get into a bowl, and now they're there, and it's the biggest thing in a decade at the school. You know, different levels of enthusiasm, coaches using the game to punish some players. You're going to sit out the first half of this bowl. You're not going to play in the bowl. You're just, you know, or reward players. You know, you're 300 yards passing away from the school passing record. We're going to do everything we can to get you that record in the bowl. There's a lot of new factors involved that come into the handicapping process for bowls. I love the entire bowl season, the way they stretch it out and put one bowl, maybe two bowls a day. It's like a little mini Super Bowl every day, because it's the highlight game. You know, there's certainly, when you bet offshore, there's all kinds of different betting options for it. So I handicap every bowl game. You know, unlike, you know, during the regular season, you can't have time to handicap every college football game. You know, a lot of times you approach them from a number standpoint. And that's a difficult thing to do for Bulls, because if you start to just say, well, I'm going to use my regular season numbers, you know, a lot of these guys with computers to determine, you know, my play for the Bull, all these situations that occur, you know, players got, you know, in the TCU Oregon game last year, they had, you know, it was a big layoff between the end of the season and the game. You had one player, Josh Doctson, who is a standout All-American wide receiver, who's anticipating that he's going to go in the first round. He's coming off an injury. He's like, okay, I'm going to play in the Bowl. I want to put my best foot forward before the draft. Less than a week before the game, he goes, you know what? I'm not going to play the game. I'm going to, you know, I don't want to get hurt or whatever it is. Then, two nights before the game starts, All-American quarterback Boykin, he gets arrested down in Arizona or wherever the game was, and he's out. You know, the line moved 7.5 points. Yeah, and do you remember the game?
No.
Probably the greatest game in Oregon, with TCU missing those two players, got up 35-0 at the half. And there were guys who played the Trevon Boykin information. In other words, TCU was a pick at that point. Overnight, Boykin gets arrested. The line starts to move in places that are open, but doesn't move in places that aren't open. It moves a total of 7 points before it's all said and done. Some guys are sitting there punching in Oregon at pick when, you know, the line's 4 here. Now it's 5 there. They're getting pick. They're getting first half pick. It's a monster, you know. What happens? 35-0, Oregon at the half. They're dancing. They lost that game. TCU came back without those players. And I think they won it in at the end of regulation. Over, they end up winning the game, you know. And by, I believe it was a touch. You know, all those tickets, you know, a good portion of them, you know, makes the bowl season, you know, so unpredictable. Is that the time period between the end of the season and the playing of the game? All kinds of things can happen. So, you know, the Final Four in the championship game is just made the entire bowl season that much more fun and attractive if you really pay attention to college football.
Do you have to give up betting on NFL in December because you don't have time to handicap too?
No. I mean, you just, you know, you have the lag, you know. But after the Army-Navy game, which I believe is December 10th, you get about a week, 8-9 days, there's no college football. So, you know, there's a lull. You just have NFL football and the season winds down. But during that time, you're handicapping your bowls. You're, you know, you're getting ready for the bowl. So it's not like you wait. You already know the matchups, you know, some of them 4 weeks in advance. So you have time to prepare for them. And then, you know, along with doing all your NFL stuff.
Are you trying to do any basketball too, or is it just too?
Yeah, this year I started doing NBA at the beginning of the season because I've done really well at it the last couple years, but picking it up only after the Super Bowl started. And I said, well, I'm just, you know, just try to incorporate it. So, you know, like when we're done here, I'm going to go do NBA till 7:30. And, you know, it's not the doesn't leave you the most well-rounded individual during the day, because it's a day, you know, basketball's a day in, day out sport. But, you know, it's good. I happen to enjoy the NBA. So it's, you know, I like the sport, and I like watching the games, and I like betting the games.
Thank you. That was very interesting. Now we're going to talk about some esports. Esports betting. What is it? And what's changed recently, Frank?
Well, in the last 10 days or so, Nevada Gaming made it legal to book certain events, esports events, which, you know, I'm not into video games, but basically it's watching two guys play video games and you're betting on which one of them's going to win. And it's a simplified explanation, but, you know, just imagine that you're good at Madden or whatever the baseball version is, and, you know, guys can bet on whether you can beat beat the other guy.
Many of these games, it's not just two guys. They're whole teams.
Yeah, it's teams, yeah. Right. Yeah, because you know, basically you're betting on people playing video games. And, you know, you have to acknowledge that, I mean, it's, you know, when you start talking about millennials, you know, they play video games and they play DFS. And Nevada wants to allow them to bet on both. I have no idea where to begin with this stuff.
Well, their tournaments, I mean, they sold out the Staples Center.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's huge, especially in Asia. So,
I mean, you go on, you know, my kids tell me that you go on YouTube. I go, what is it that you're watching? you know, people watch other people playing video games, and those, you know, the people who post those videos make a lot of money because they get that many hits of people. I don't understand it for the life of me. I can't figure out why you would want to sit there and watch somebody else play a video game, but that's what they do, and it's grown in popularity to the point where people are more than interested in betting on it. So you can bet on it, and I'll throw up my hands and say it's not my cup of tea. I don't know where I would start handicapping, you know, a bunch of Asian kids playing Warcraft.
That's because the kids all play it. Right. You know, they all play these games, and they watch these other guys play them so well. You know, just like we'd watch any athlete or anyone else, and they're like, "Wow, did you see what he just did?" Because they understand it. You know, we don't understand what we're watching, but they do.
Right, and also, you know, they have Twitch TV, just like poker does, where you can watch them play, and just like poker, they can comment on what they're doing while they're doing it. Yeah. So.
It's, I guess it's an interactive thing to a certain degree.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have a nephew who, I mean, I've had this on my television in my house where they're watching this stuff and, you know, well, yeah, they're totally into it.
Here's what it is. They want the casinos so badly want to crack this millennial problem of non-gambling. You know, I mean, the millennials spend their money in the clubs and things like that, but they cannot get them to the casino floor. They keep trying to do these skill-based games and all of that, which are like tic-tac-toe games to these kids. You know, I mean, they don't care about this stuff. This is one thing that seems to have tread for the casinos, that they can get millennials betting on these, you know, these superstars of the video games and such. And that's what they see. They see a way to finally crack the millennial problem of getting them on the gambling floor one way or another. I've always said, geez, man, just let them play against one another and make it a pair of mutual and take your cut. And you know.
Well, that's what they're doing at the Grand. Although I think right now they're returning 100% of the profit. And now, you know, every single article you read about this all would mention how the Downtown Grand had built this, parlor. Well, now the Silver Sevens has put one in. And on Sunday nights, the Silver Sevens has these tournaments. And they're cheap, $15 a head or whatever. But the casino manager in the article I read said, you know, normally the average age of the customer in the Silver Sevens is over 55, but on Sunday nights, it's about 25. Hmm. And, yeah, so more of them are trying it and just getting them in the door, hoping that they're not making any money on the tournament itself. Mm-hmm. They're just hoping that after it's over, they'll maybe hit the tables or the slots or whatever.
Well, they're also building, building a big esports arena at Neonopolis as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that will tie in probably with the Grand a little bit. But, you know, you always read about that, the Downtown Grand, and they've got this esports initiative and all that kind of thing. And you go and you look in there, and it's like half of an old VIP room with a couple of wires laying around.
Yeah, lots of wires strung everywhere. Yeah. You know, some kid, you know, and it's such a self-contained thing. You know, they're sitting there, you know, intensely staring at a screen. You know, it's not exactly the most exciting thing if you're an observer walking by looking in and go, wow, look at the fun they're having in there.
But, you know, my son just said to me today that for his friends, now, admittedly, he's more sophisticated a gambler than the average 22-year-old. But what he said to me is that the games in Las Vegas are so bad that the kids his age would rather spend their money than gamble it at these games that are so horrible.
Yeah, I believe it.
So,
well, they're trying. I saw yesterday, I met somebody from Station Casinos, Stacey Alonso, who's the marketing director at Station. And she showed me a video of herself testing a millennial type gambling game that they're trying to bring in, where you literally go into a virtual reality thing, put on the goggles.
Oh, in the cube?
Yeah.
In the glass cube?
And everyone can watch you.
Yeah, I saw that.
And she was doing it. It is hilarious because she said, you know, she's just shaking and shimmying and swinging stuff and everything else. She's got like an imaginary flashlight in one hand, a gun in another. But you can't see that from the outside, but you can watch it. Yeah. I said, are you really looking at bringing this to the floor? She said, yeah. She says, we are looking at, the industry is looking at bringing these kinds of things to the floor.
Yeah, that technology is something else. I had the opportunity over Thanksgiving. My nephew, he had a virtual reality thing. You put it on, and then you plug it in, and you play. You go down into a shark tank, and there's, I mean, it is very realistic. And, you know, it'll make you twitch and look down and just, you know, it's very impressive and entertaining.
It'll be fun to watch. Then it'll be fun to watch.
Right.
But I mean, the point is they're not stopping on this. I really thought this was going to be a fad from the casino's point of view, where they finally said, oh, fooey on it. they're not stopping. I mean, they're convinced that this is the way they go to go, and that they've got to bring this group in.
Well, they haven't really done anything yet. You know, I think it'll take a while to see whether
You got
to
combine the experience with the gambling element. You got to marry the two. Then you'd be making money off of it.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of these young players are going to go broke when they gamble, because we're used to seeing people older going broke when they gamble. What happens when a millennial goes broke when he's?
He has plenty of time to replenish the bankroll.
Right. He goes back to his parents' basement and gets a job at Starbucks.
That's right.
Very good. So it's not as serious to go broke when you're 20 as when you're 60. That's for sure. All right. We've been talking to Anthony Curtis and Frank B. Entertaining show. Richard, how can people get a hold of us?
First of all, we really encourage your questions. You can send them to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or our Facebook page, facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge. Or you can just post them at gamblingwithanedge.com in the comments sections. Or you can tweet them at me at RWM21. You can get copies of the show delivered to you automatically every week at iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or at gamblingwithanedge.com. And for an archive of every show that we've done, you can find that at bobdancer.com.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Anthony. Thank you, Frank. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.